A law passes the Senate in Tennessee allowing teachers to carry weapons. A new study suggests that Gen Zers are far more anti-Israel as a whole than other generations. And generative AI arrives in the world of gene editing. These are the stories we'll discuss today, and we will also address some of your questions. I'm your host, Sean McDowell.
And I'm your co-host, Scott Ray.
This is the Think Biblically Weekly Cultural Update, brought to you by Talbot School of Theology, Biola University. Now, Scott, before we jump into these three stories and take questions, you have a very interesting update on what we discussed last week related to the CAS study.
Yes, and it's an update actually from earlier in the week and then updated again as of yesterday. So this is hot off the press. Remember last week we talked about the CAS report, which was commissioned by the National Health Service in the UK to try and get at what are the benefits and what are the risks and what is the evidence that gender-affirming treatments actually do the things that they're claiming that they do. Hilary Cass is a very prominent senior pediatrician in the UK and was head of a team that did this research. Let's just say the bottom line was the Cass report was highly critical of the use of puberty blockers, gender reassignment surgery in minors. This was not with adults, but it was minors under the age of 18. And they concluded that there's no evidence that it helps gender dysphoria and no evidence that it is actually addressing the underlying psychological conditions that give rise to gender dysphoria in the first place. In fact, a group of about 20 or so prominent UK psychologists came out publicly in The Guardian this week, wrote a joint letter to the editor, basically saying that they are embarrassed by their profession, in that gender-affirming treatments are routinely ignoring these underlying psychological conditions. Now, CAS's response, as you might expect, the CAS report got a ton of criticism, not only in the UK, but all from the US especially, but all over the world. And she, as you might expect, she pushed back and accused her critics of spreading widespread disinformation, outright falsehoods about the studies that went into the CAS report, and basically was incensed at the failure of people to interact objectively with the data that was presented, and she viewed it the triumph of ideology over empirical evidence. Now she has had concerns for her safety. She's been subject to online abuse. She is no longer using public transport for fear of her safety. And just yesterday, she announced that she's been given a police escort for any time she goes out in public. She's also made it clear that she will not be involved in the National Health Service's research on gender treatments for adults. And the tragedy is that these attempts to discredit her, to threaten her, to otherwise silence her, I think show the triumph of ideology over some of the things that science, I think, has made clear.
You know, a couple quick thoughts. I understand why a lot of doctors and medics, given the pushback on her, don't want to deal with this and the pushback and just got into medicine because they want to help people. But on the flip side, it takes people like her with the courage she has to speak up and kind of take the hits, I hate to say it, to give other people the courage to push back on this and really follow where the evidence leads. So we will continue to follow this. That's a really, really helpful update. Now, Scott, this story, this main story we're jumping in, saw this in the New York Times, that it was covered all over in a range of different publications. It's about Tennessee passing a bill to allow teachers to carry concealed handguns. In part, I picked this because just about 2 weeks ago, it was the 25th anniversary, for lack of a better term, from the Columbine shooting in 1999. So I kind of wanted to bring it full circle and just talk about where are we now with school shootings? And are we at the point where we should seriously consider letting teachers be armed? Now, here's some of the details. Tennessee lawmakers passed a bill on Tuesday to allow teachers and other school staff members to carry concealed handguns on school campuses. The measure, if it becomes law, would require those carrying guns to go through training and have to have the approval of school officials, but parents and most other employees would not be notified. The bill is one of the most significant pieces of public safety legislation to advance in Tennessee after the school shooting about a year ago, which was at a private Christian school in Nashville, not a public school, that left three students and three staff members dead. The attack galvanized parents and school and many others in Tennessee, including the state's Republican governor, to demand action that could prevent similar violence. Now, when something horrible happens like this, it's just human nature to want to do something. The question is this the right thing? Many of them believe that restricting access to guns was the solution. And critics of the legislation have argued that bringing more weapons onto school campuses would not improve safety and could even amplify the danger. So really the question is that you and I have talked about is, are we going to cut down on dangerous school shootings by getting rid of all guns or bringing more on with the right people? But everybody wants to get rid of school shootings. Now, here's some of the requirements. For example, it says staff members must complete 40 hours of school policing training, undergo a background check, submit fingerprints to state and federal authorities, submit a psychological certification from a licensed health provider, and the handgun cannot be carried in auditoriums or stadiums during school events, during disciplinary or tenure meetings, or in a clinic, which raises an interesting question. If you have armed staff and faculty, where are they going to lead it if they can't leave it if they can't go into certain areas? That's an important question. Now, I didn't know this. Maybe you knew this, Scott, but roughly half of U.S. states allow teachers or other school employees with concealed carry permits to have firearms on campus. That stunned me. I don't know how I missed that. Now, this bill is waiting for the governor to sign it or not. But here's just one thing that I found that I want you to weigh in here. I found this article in the Tennessean this week where they reached out to superintendents in Middle Tennessee asking what they thought about this legislation. And none immediately said, good, we would like to arm teachers. I didn't find a single school that said that. Most kind of said with a political fair response, we want to review the legislation. But then most also said it seems to be safest to have an armed guard on campus at the front and in the back. And at our private Christian school, where I still teach one class where my kids go, there's an armed guard at the front. There's an armed guard at the back. And that engenders at least a feeling of a lot of safety on that campus. Now, your thoughts on this bill that's pending?
Well, I think some of the reason for this is that you have in some states like Tennessee, I think you have schools in more rural areas where police presence cannot be counted on to be as timely as it might be in an urban area or in a bigger city. I think that's one of the reasons for passing a law like this. And it is, I think my guess is that many of our listeners may not know that roughly half of U.S. states allow teachers or other school employees who have concealed carry permits already to have firearms on campus.
Yeah.
So I think here, just a couple of observations. You sort of mentioned this, where one of the restrictions in the Tennessee law is that they can't carry them in auditoriums or stadiums during school events or during disciplinary or tenure meetings. I thought those, I suspect, would be the kinds of events where you would most want to have someone armed. Because, you know, when you have students gathered in large crowds in closed spaces, that's sort of that's the prime target for a school shooter. So the places where mass shootings could be the most damaging, I think, are the places where the law actually prohibits people with concealed carry permits from actually having their weapons there. Now, one of the things, I understand the sort of the instinctive view that, if we have more guns, that just means more possibilities for things to go off the rails. But one of the things that we don't know about gun laws and the statistics on gun deaths is how many acts of violence have been deterred without shots ever having been fired. Just by having people who want to do harm know that there are people who are armed in the particular place where they want to go, to bring harm. I think that acts as a significant deterrent just by itself. Now, for some, for some, nothing's going to be an adequate deterrent in that way. But I think the tension in this is that we just don't know what the effect of people being armed is in those instances where people see that, and, you know, they see that somebody is armed, and they just decide not to go down that road. That's why it's always struck me that schools or public places that advertise themselves as no gun zones,
right,
are, you know, to use a bad pun, are actually shooting themselves in the foot, and creating a situation that I suspect they want to avoid. Mm. Here's the other thing that I think is interesting on this. Is it, you know, to think biblically about this, the Bible, I think, protects the right of self-defense in the face of a mortal threat. The book of Esther, for example, when a declaration of genocide went out in the Persian kingdom to exercise genocide against the Jewish community there, those decrees could not be withdrawn, so Jews were given the right to arm themselves, to protect themselves, and to take plunder from the people who came to attack them. Same took place in Nehemiah, when basically half the people that rebuilt the city were construction workers, and the other half were the armed guards who were out there guarding them. And, you know, I think that our Second Amendment protects the right to bear arms individually. It's not, I don't think that just refers to a state-sanctioned militia or the military, because in the time of the founders, the state-sanctioned militia would not have been effective had the individuals not had the right to bear arms in their homes and to be competent to carry them. And I think that, you know, I think the combination of the scripture and the Second Amendment, although I think the Second Amendment, you know, reasonable restrictions on the right of gun ownership, background checks, you know, mental health checks, you know, denying guns and permits to people who have clear mental health issues. Those, I think, are consistent with what the Second Amendment lays out in the Constitution.
Mm. I think a couple things to me. If I was going to allow teachers and other staff to be armed, I would want it to feel like this is kind of a last resort and we've tried everything else. I don't know what happened at this Christian school in Tennessee, but I suspect there might be some other steps as a whole we can take before we need to move to this. I think our Christian school has done a good job with a guard, with how they've set up the school, with protections and drills. You know, the big picture of things, the chances that a kid is going to get shot or a teacher in school shooting in any school is really, really low. That's something we have to keep in mind as well. Although sadly, we've seen a lot of these cases happen. The other question is, you know, of these states that allow roughly half to carry concealed permits, this varies by state. And so in principle, if you have a teacher or staff member who has military background, who has police background, I have no problem with them being armed. In fact, I would almost want them to. I would just want to make sure that this training is completely above and beyond anything you would possibly need for something to go wrong, and that we'd err on the side of overtraining such teachers who want to do it. I've taught in a private school 21 years. I don't want to carry a gun. My wife's not going to want to carry a gun. But if there's some people that said, we're going to go over the top in our training and learn this and practice, I think I would be in favor of that on a smaller scale. But I'd have to be convinced of the level of training to do so.
Yeah, I'm not persuaded that the 40 hours of training that's mandatory that this law requires is sufficient.
Agreed.
And I would prefer to have the people who are armed to have had some sort of military or law enforcement style training. I think what your Christian school is doing is, I think, is clearly a step in the right direction. My only question is that something that had been tried in some of these Tennessee schools,
right,
and not been sufficient. And that'd be the only question that remains.
That's fair enough. I think, you know, probably 99% of these teachers in Tennessee did not get into teaching thinking they'd have to potentially carry a gun to school. The message that sends in itself has to be taken really, really seriously.
Well, I think that's actually driven a lot of good teachers out of the profession, is realizing that they might be subject to that kind of violence that would necessitate somebody being armed on their campus. I don't think too many teachers went into teaching signing up for that.
I agree. That's for sure. Well, let's shift to our second story here. And this was in Newsweek. A friend of mine sent this to me. And the title is Poll Seeks to Unravel Why Gen Z Appears More Anti-Israel Than Others. It said a few things. It says, as protests engulf American universities, and as of today, it was about 120 universities plus, over Israel's response to an October 7th attack by Hamas. A Christian group behind a poll released Monday says it knows why Gen Z has a more favorable opinion of the terrorist group than do others, and it is Israel is more powerful, thus it's the oppressor. Now, what caught my attention in the study is that this is from a friend of ours at Biola who we've had on the podcast, Scott, yes. Dr. Jeff Myers, who's the president of Summit Ministries. And they asked this question. So Summit Ministries commissioned this poll with Rasmussen RMG Research Group. They said, do you believe that Israel's wealth and military power make its campaign against Hamas unjust? Gen Zers, it said 47% of that group say Israel is unjust for the reason outlined, meaning that it is more powerful and is viewed as the oppressor. Dr. Myers said, we are now seeing the logical outcome of an education system that teaches students to see the world through a lens of racialist resentment. And then he has a really powerful line in here that we're going to have to discuss a little bit. He says, Gen Z is so embarrassed about being American that a large swath of them have become terrorist sympathizers. Now, at the end of this article, again, in Newsweek, it says the poll released on Monday also asked whether Israel has a right to exist as a nation in the Middle East. Overall, 10% of voters believe that Israel does not. So 90% of voters in the U.S. say Israel has a right to exist as a nation in the Middle East. 33% of Gen Z voters do not believe Israel has a right to exist. 33% do not. The poll also indicated that 81% of voters believe that Hamas is a terrorist group. So 8 out of 10 Americans. But among Gen Zers, 61% recognize Hamas as a terrorist group. That means 39%, basically 4 out of 10 Gen Zers in this poll, which would basically be people roughly 12 to about 27, 28 years old, 4 in 10 do not believe that Hamas is a terrorist group. Now, I've got some thoughts and reflections on this, but tell me what you make of it.
Well, I found this to be somewhat alarming. That, you know, the Gen Z group polled as honestly as they did and in the way that they did. And I think our friend Jeff Myers hit the nail right on the head when he identified this as a worldview issue. And I think there is a worldview that's governing the protests. And we saw this is also the week that we saw not just protests on many college campuses, we saw protest encampments.
That's right.
On these campuses. And we saw students being arrested for trespassing and disrupting the normal life of the university. And these are Harvard, Yale, Columbia, NYU, Stanford, Berkeley, you know, very prestigious schools. And our friend John McWhorter, who's a professor at Columbia, has been witness to this. And there was actually a professor at Columbia, a Jewish professor, who went to campus earlier this week, and his ID card no longer worked to get him onto the campus, and it had been revoked because he's Jewish and because the administration feared for his safety, and was asking for him basically to teach remotely for the rest of the term. And his comment was, This feels like 1938 in Germany, when Jews didn't feel safe in their own homeland. Right? Now, I think he's probably overstated that a bit. But I think that sense of fear among Jewish people, and there's, you know, Jewish campus organizations having some of these schools have encouraged their students to actually go home for the rest of the semester because they don't have any confidence that the university or the local police are able to protect them adequately. So that we see all that happening at the same time. But I think Myers is right on this. It is a neo-Marxist worldview. Anybody who thought that Marxism was swept into the dustbin of history at the close of the Cold War was sadly mistaken. Marxism is alive and well at its most fundamental worldview component, and that is that the worldview sees the world fundamentally through the lenses of the oppressor or the oppressed, and you are in one group or the other depending on your race, your gender, your sexuality, your socioeconomic status, whatever it might be. And if you have money and power, you are automatically considered an oppressor class. And Israel, and that's I think the point of the question, Israel has wealth and power. I think it doesn't hurt that most of the Israelis are also white. And that they are deemed the oppressor by virtue of who they are, not so much on the basis of what they have done. So as applied to Israel specifically, this is a pretty nearsighted view of history, because the Holocaust did not occur all that long ago. Yeah. And the idea of, you know, never again is making, I think, a lot of Jewish people around the world wonder if this is, you know, maybe the beginnings of something like this happening again. So we forget that the Jewish people, they've had a long history of being driven out of their countries. They've had a long, for most of their history, they have been the oppressed, overwhelmingly so. And I think to think biblically about this worldview, this is, I think, fundamentally at odds with the Scripture's view of sin and of accountability. Because as Alexander Solzhenitsyn, I think, put it so eloquently, the line between good and evil does not run between us and them. It runs down the heart of each of us, contains that capacity for both good and evil. And whether you have evil in you, whether you are potentially an oppressor or not, has nothing to do with your group identity, your race, your sexuality. What it has more to do is that we all are fundamentally have the potential to be oppressors because of our innate inclination to sin.
That's a great distinction. And our colleague Thaddeus Williams, in his book that I think is wonderful, Confronting Injustice Without Compromising Truth, says critical theory divides the world up into oppressed and oppressors, and sin is being in the oppressor class. The Bible says we are all sinful before God and levels the playing field, even though oppression is something the Bible takes seriously as well. Now, that said, I had mixed feelings when I saw this, Scott. On one level, like you, I thought, holy cow, how do we get to the point where 40% almost of Gen Z doesn't recognize that Hamas is a terrorist organization? It's not like 40% is just being critical of, say, Israel's tactics. There's a big difference between saying, I have sympathy for the Palestinian people, I disagree with how Israel has approached this. Fine, we can have that debate and that conversation. But to not recognize that Hamas is a terrorist organization, that 40% to me is stunning. Now, on the other hand, I'm not super surprised, because I've been tracking the data on Gen Z, and compared to baby boomers, Gen Z is 57% less likely to say they are proud to live in the U.S. 57% less likely than baby boomers to say they're proud to live in the U.S. According to a Pew poll, half of Americans believe U.S. is the greatest country in the world, what we might call American exceptionalism. 32% of Gen Zers believe that. So given that there's the skepticism of American exceptionalism, and America is so tied behind Israel, there's going to be skepticism about Israel. I think that ties together. Also, the other piece is how this generation gets their news. A huge percentage now get their news from TikTok. And for obvious reasons, that's even less reliable than typically what Google is going to be for different reasons. I mean, there was a trend not long ago about Osama bin Laden and people saying he was misunderstood and it was shared and viewed millions and millions of times. Now, my daughter shows me some of these. She's 17, will show me some of these crazy videos that come up and we'll talk about it and we'll process it and we'll try to give them perspective. But if you don't have parents or grandparents or really intentional teachers who are going to help you weed fact from fiction relationally, you're going to easily buy into some of these narratives. And frankly, a lot of the people at these protests we've seen through some of the interviews don't really know the difference between Hamas and the Palestinian people. They don't know what the war is about. They don't understand what Zionism is. And this is where Mick Horder's article, I think, is really helpful. He weighs in here and he says, this is his opinion piece in the New York Times. He also talks about the worldview piece that you hit on, Scott. He says, conversations I've had with people heatedly opposed to the war in Gaza, signage and writings on social media and elsewhere, and anti-Israel and generally hard leftist comments that I've heard for decades on campuses place these confrontations within a larger battle against power structures. Again, he's a Columbia professor. Here in the form of what they call colonialism and genocide and against whiteness. The idea is that Jewish students and faculty should be able to tolerate all of this because they are white. I mean, that's an insightful thing. And then the last point he makes in this article is he says, today's protesters don't hate Israel's government any more than yesterday's hated South Africa's. And he explains why in the article he thinks that's the case. But they have pursued their goals with a markedly different tenor, in part because of the single-mindedness of anti-racist academic culture, and in part because of the influence of iPhones and social media, which inherently encourage a heightened degree of performance. It is a part of the warp and whoop of today's protest that they're being recorded from many angles for the world to see. One speaks up. So social media has changed everything about how people protest things like the war in Israel. And so any other thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think our friend John McWhorter, I think, was pretty insightful on this. And I think he adds a level of nuance that I think is important in this. And his point is that the line between anti-Semitism and anti-Israel is often a fine line, in that you can be critical of Israel without necessarily being anti-Semitic. But as our friend Russell Moore pointed out, his blog yesterday entitled More to the Point, his main point in this is, listen to the chants.
Yep.
That come out of these protests. And what's the most common chant that has emerged in the pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian protests? That's from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free. Now think about that. From the river to the sea is from the Jordan River on the eastern border to the Mediterranean Sea on the western border of Israel and all in between. And this is where I think Gen Z, 33% of Gen Z, you had mentioned, holds that Israel had no right to exist. Now, this is where I think the fine line sometimes gets crossed. And I think McWhorter says there are times when the rhetoric gets crossed too. And if you believe that from the river to the sea, Palestine shall be free, where do you propose that the Jews actually go? That's never made clear. I think what's presumed is that the Jews should end up going into the sea. And that's, I think, the chant from the river to the sea actually, I think it's intended in a lot of places. Now, it's chanted by some people who don't know what they're chanting, to be sure. I think it is intended by some people as a denial of Israel's right as a nation to exist. And we know there's a long historical tradition of what happened to Jewish people when they did not have a state of Israel. And I think those Jews that are living in other parts of the world, particularly in Europe, are feeling some of the same, that same sense of insecurity and uneasiness about being Jews in some of those parts of the world. So I think that's the only thing that I would want to know a little bit more from the protesters. Where do you suggest that the Jews actually go in order to live in peace?
That's a great question. That's a really interesting question to see how they would respond. You know, one final thing on this is we also see with Gen Z less concern about socialism and higher views about the positive role of socialism. And some of this is because they didn't grow up during communism. They don't remember the Cold War. It's not their fault. I'm not piling on them. It's just different historical perspective. So I have talked with my kids about what it was like to visit Russia in 1991 and see the way it was and the effects of communism. We need to have conversations with our kids about what's going on, separating fact from fiction, especially given what's coming through the educational system many times, what's coming through social media. That's our job to do so. So this is a reminder, reach out and start talking with your kids early.
That's a great point. I visited Czechoslovakia in 1972.
Oh, wow.
Just 4 years after Russian tanks came rolling through the city of Prague. Mm. And I would suggest, you know, talk for some of who I think, you know, have an overly optimistic view of socialism. I think some of that has to do with the economic inequalities that we see today and some of the abuses of the market system we see today. But I would suggest, you know, talk to some of the people who live in Miami who fled Castro's Cuba.
That's right.
And what life was like under communism, because it's not just economic freedom, it's political freedom as well. And religious freedom goes hand in hand, but it's not an accident that these were all avowedly atheistic regimes.
Mm.
So good
point.
Good observations on this.
Well, let's jump to this third story. And as soon as I saw this, I was like, man, I am glad Scott is my co-host here because I think this is right in your lane. But this is an article also in the New York Times, and it says, generative AI arrives in the gene editing world of CRISPR. Now, here's a few things about this, then maybe you can kind of clarify it for us. It says, generative AI can write poetry in computer programs or create images of teddy bears. This is things like ChatGPT and others, and videos of cartoon characters that look like something from a Hollywood movie. Now, new AI technology is generating blueprints for microscopic biological mechanisms that can edit your DNA, pointing to a future when scientists can battle illness and disease with even greater precision and speed than they can today. Much as ChatGPT learns to generate language by analyzing Wikipedia articles, books, and chat logs, etc., Profluent, the name of the company that created this technology, its technology creates a new gene editors after analyzing enormous amounts of biological data, including microscopic mechanisms that scientists already use to edit human DNA. And they compare and contrast this with CRISPR. Now, the goal of this, of course, is to build technologies that can improve medical care. For example, they say that can work to accelerate the development of new vaccines and medicines. And they also make the point that this is unlikely to affect healthcare in the short run. This is just the beginnings of the technology that can potentially do this. But I was actually surprised in this article. It's almost all positive until at the end, they're like, well, and here's a couple small concerns. I'm watching this whole thing feeling like this is like a science fiction film that leads to disaster. Maybe I just don't understand the technology enough, but what's your take on this?
Well, let me give, Sean, maybe the best place to start, let me give our listeners a little bit of background on what CRISPR is in the first place.
That'd be great.
Because CRISPR is the real thing. And it's basically a human creation. It came out of the labs at UC Berkeley. And it's basically a pair of genetic scissors. They're proteins that function like a pair of genetic scissors that enable researchers to cut and paste in the human genetic code in sex cells and very early stage embryos. The reason they do it in those is because those changes are sort of once for all. And though once you make those changes, they're called germline changes, where they are that you have the potential now to pass along those genetic alterations to succeeding generations. Okay, so it may, whether it's a dominant or recessive gene will depend on that'll determine whether it is inherited by the next generation, but it's in the gene pool now, and is possible to be inherited. So, for things like some of the early CRISPR treatments, for things like sickle cell anemia. Which is a terrible disease that affects African-American children. And to be able to cure that once for all, Curtis, at the genetic level, would be a huge medical advance, as opposed to having to treat it or to do a form of gene therapy that has shown to be, I say, only mildly successful in the past. So CRISPR, I mean, everybody was thrilled when this came online about 5 years ago. And we've seen this to treat disease. We've seen this being used to treat a number of, single gene, really severe, fatal genetic diseases. Mm. And it's great hope for the future, too. Now, getting AI involved makes this a little different story. And here's what AI does is it doesn't actually do the gene editing itself. But the AI scans volumes and volumes of biological data, much like ChatGPT does to literature.
Okay.
And it gives researchers the ability to create in the lab. Basically AI gives them the blueprint for creating these microscopic mechanisms, these microorganisms that once unleashed in the body would do the gene editing by themselves. So it could do this much quicker, much more efficient. I think it didn't mention this in the article. It's a question that I have. I wonder, since it enables gene editing to be scaled so enormously, I wonder if this opens up the possibility to do gene editing on adults, where you have to do what's called somatic cell treatment, is to treat one person at a time. And you could do that because you now have the ability to do that on such a widespread scale. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the hope is that we can do this more quickly, more efficiently, and more broadly on human beings. Now, here's the cautions, and I think the New York Times piece only mentions the possibility of this getting into the hands of bad actors who want to unleash harmful things in the genetic code and sort of the ultimate form of biological terrorism. But there's also, I think, other things to be concerned about. We know that ChatGPT, and that's what its function, that's basically it's built on analogy with ChatGPT, that version of AI has been also been nicknamed, the AI stands for not artificial intelligence, but allegedly inaccurate. And that there are, that AI will often make up things. They often get facts incorrect. I've often cautioned students against using AI in their papers to be, at least make sure it gets the facts right, because often they don't. And for people who actually know something about the subject, that's easy to spot. And making gene editing errors, I don't think is out of the realm of possibility. And some of those errors may be things that we actually don't even know about today as possibilities. Let me give you an example. In the early gene therapy that was designed to treat sickle cell anemia, it had to render a certain gene inert so that it didn't turn on the things that created the sickle cell, the anemia disease. What we didn't expect and nobody saw that coming is that it also, in making that gene inert, it also turned off the genetic resistance of the body to malaria.
Oh, gosh.
And so we think this is great that we're curing sickle cell anemia, but we've unleashed something that nobody expected. And if that's done in early stage embryos or sex cells, we've unleashed that possibly in a number of succeeding generations. That's a big problem. And nobody saw that coming. Now, we've learned a lot about the genetic code since then, but there's still, I think most geneticists will tell you, there's still a lot of mystery in our DNA code. And there's still the possibility of these unanticipated, unintended side effects, some of which could be catastrophic. It's not clear from this piece. I'd have to do a little bit more work on this to know for sure how they put guardrails on this to keep that kind of thing from happening. But we've seen this happen before. And I think with ChatGPT as the model for this, we should anticipate this happening again. So that I think that's a big concern in my view. And maybe we go back to the days where human beings do this, you know, one sex cell, one embryo at a time. Maybe that's the safest way. For a long time, we have prohibited germline gene therapy because we just didn't know what we might be unleashing on succeeding generations. I think that caution is still appropriate today, particularly in an age of AI when there's so much that we don't know about how this is actually going to function.
So you've been concerned with intentional use. Like if they can make vaccines with this, could they use it to make harmful viruses in some fashion? That's intentional bad actors.
Right.
But there's also the unintentional kind of side effects.
Unforeseen,
unanticipated side effects. And how much confidence do you have that the concerns you're raising will be raised and these lessons you describe from sickle cell anemia have been learned, or that now that this is in the hands of some private company, they're just going to march forward unaware because of potential profit?
Well, I think I would never underestimate the lure of profit. This thing that happened with sickle cell anemia set the gene therapy industry back years and years.
Mm.
So I would think it's in the self-interest of the companies that are doing this research and marketing it to make sure that we don't get anything like that happening again. Because all it takes is one catastrophic side effect, and you know, everybody's going to start raising questions, and the scrutiny's going to come, and it's going to set the industry back. Now, maybe appropriately so. And I mean, if that's the case, then we let the chips fall where they will on that. But that's where my question has to do with what are the guardrails that are in place.
That's great.
To make sure that we don't get either intended or unintended abuse.
The upside of this is really powerful. The article says, in the long term, could lead to a world where medicines and treatments are quickly tailored to individual people even faster than we can do today. That's amazing. And then it says, scientists have long cautioned against using CRISPR, and this is just CRISPR alone, for human enhancement because it is a relatively new technology that could potentially have undesired side effects, such as triggering cancer, and have warned against unethical uses, such as genetically modifying human embryos. So they're aware of that. AI adds a whole nother layer to the potential that CRISPR itself could go wrong. Let's hope they slow down and heed this to not undermine really the goals of why they're doing it in the first place.
I think the concern about enhancement is a justifiable one, though I think that will be increasingly harder and harder to resist. Because I used to tell my students, you know, back when you were a student and even, you know, even later than that, that the days of, you know, science being able to allow parents to create designer children will not happen in our lifetime. I was wrong, because CRISPR has given us the tools to do that. Now, thankfully, nobody has gone down that road yet, except there are a couple people in China that tried this. But nobody's gone down that road yet. But, you know, lots of our medical treatments have dual uses, where they treat disease, but they also help enhance otherwise normal traits. And it's things that are really mainstream now. Drugs that are designed to treat some of the memory loss in Alzheimer's are being given to people my age who have memory loss. Beta blockers that are used to treat social anxiety disorder are being given to concert musicians to calm their nerves before they go, you know, perform at Carnegie Hall, or neurosurgeons before they do very delicate neurosurgery. And I admit, I sort of like the idea of having my neurosurgeon having his nerves calm.
Right.
But, you know, I think where you draw the line between treatment and enhancement, I think gets a little fuzzy. And that's a hard one to draw in every case. So I think they're right to be concerned about human enhancement. But I think that genie's out of the bottle already. And the technology, we're just waiting for the technology to catch up to what philosophers have already been suggesting is okay to do.
Good stuff. Very helpful. Appreciate your clarification on that topic and the technology. Well, we'll
hope our listeners think it's clear.
Let us know. Shoot us emails, clarification challenges, questions. In fact, as always, we have three great questions. And I think this first one is for you. I'll set it up here for you. And it says, my question concerns which social cultural issues should be decided by the secular government. If I understand you correctly, Scott, you think that the government should only be involved when, quote, fundamental civil rights are at stake, which is not applicable when adultery takes place in a marriage context. Would you please provide a definition of fundamental civil rights?
Go ahead. Well, let me clarify what I intended to say. I didn't say that fundamental civil rights were the only reason government could get involved, but they are. It is a very important reason that in matters of life and death, on moral issues that have fundamental civil rights at stake, like the right to life, for example, and the right to private property would be, I think, another one, which explains why we have laws against theft and laws against murder, for example. But I think also when a certain behavior creates a level of harm that society as a whole deems unacceptable, I think it's appropriate for government to step in there as well. So the prevention, I think people have a fundamental right to be prevented from experiencing harm if it's in someone's power to prevent them from. Now, some is going to be, of course, random and unpreventable.
Sure.
But that's what I mean by those fundamental civil rights. The point I was making, and I think this is the big takeaway that I want people to see, is that just because the Bible outlines a moral position, nothing necessarily follows about what the law should be without an additional argument.
Gotcha.
So my point about marriage is not that the law shouldn't necessarily be involved, but that nothing necessarily follows about what the law should be based on what the Bible teaches. Okay? And I think in general, things that do not cause significant harm, that are done among consenting adults, should not be a matter for the law, because I don't think fundamental civil rights are at stake. Now, I think you can make a good argument that marriage was instituted prior to the entrance of sin, which means it's something that's for human beings in general, and that therefore ought to be a matter for, you know, whether somebody's a believer or not, they ought to be subject to that. Okay, but I think you can also make an argument that government shouldn't be in the marriage business at all, because marriage is ultimately God's business, and that's something that churches and synagogues and mosques should be able to make their own judgments about that. Now, the only caveat for that would be, except for when the interests of children are at stake. And to provide the best environment for children, I think children have a fundamental civil right to have the best possible environment that their parents can provide for them. Like we've said before on this show, parents are morally obligated to give their kids the best opportunities that they can. And the kids have a claim on the parents for that, and we've mentioned that also applies to children in the womb, if that's true of children outside the womb. So that was my point that I wanted to make, and I trust that answers the questioner's query.
I think you did. Now, raise another question we won't go into, but you said you could make the case that marriage is something that churches decide, and some Christians have made that case, but that's also to recognize there's a reason why states and governments have interest in marriage, like you said, for the kids, because it is the institution that has been proven to have kids that have the least behavior problems, so to speak, that affect society as a whole, such as staying out of prison, etc. And so, and I don't, nobody hears me saying, if you come from a broken home, you're going to prison. That is not my point. True. I'm saying as a whole, you have a huge advantage of avoiding those kind of negative outcomes if you have a mom and dad in the home caring for you. And so governments have been invested in this institution, not because of what scripture says or doesn't say, but because marriage is an objective good for the flourishing of society as a whole. So as marriages crumble, society crumbles. Now, we're not having that debate here, but that's where Christians may differ a little bit and make different cases. All right, let's go to this next one. This actually came from a really thoughtful physician who sent us a long email. I wish we could read all of it. And we kind of condensed it down to comment on this a little bit. So we're going to do our best here. And he said, roughly, I have a thought related to the sex, gender, language debate. We're often told that gender and sex have had different meanings for at least 100 years. That isn't true. I've been a physician for 45 years. When I started medical school, I bought one of the two main professional medical dictionaries at the time. I still have it. The only definition it has for gender is the anatomical sex of an individual. That's really interesting. So that would have been 45 years sometime in the 70s. He says, I know the definition of words may change with time, but I have difficulty with the claim that these two words are different. How should we address this gender sex misinformation, especially when so many in the culture drive a wedge between these fundamental concepts that belong together? Now, I'd only make one distinction here. It might be different how it was used in, say, the university and a popular culture versus in medical dictionaries. There could be one that shifted earlier than the other. Genuinely, I guess here's kind of the debate, Scott, is should Christians look at gender and sex and use them as synonyms for the same thing? Or can we make a distinction that biological sex refers to your physical anatomy and gender refers to the way you express that anatomy, but we just need to make sure gender is connected to biological sex and not divorced? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I found myself going back and forth on this. I mean, I found myself saying that, you know, sex is a biological fact, gender is a social construct. And I've also used sex and gender interchangeably. And I think, you know, that, and when I do that, that reflect different audiences that I'm speaking to. And I think the issues about gender, when the medical textbooks were written, are different than they are today. There was no need to distinguish between those two, you know, years and years ago. Now, I'm open to the idea that it may be the correct thing to do to take those as interchangeable. But I'm also open to the idea that as long, and I think your caveat in this is really helpful, is as long as it's not divorced from biological sex, and that as long as gender is not something that is entirely subjective, I think gender has more to do with the cultural norms and expression of someone's biological sex, and so what the gender expectations are can be different depending on the particular culture that you're in. And I think we want to be really careful about gender expectations for male and female that are contrary to Scripture, because I'm not convinced that the Marlboro man has much to do with the biblical view of masculinity, and I certainly don't think that the Betty Crocker view of women belonging in the home has much to do with the biblical view of femininity either. You just look at Proverbs 31. That woman was a thoroughgoing entrepreneur, and it was widely respected in her community. So, I think it just depends on what level of nuance is required for the particular audience you're addressing. And just to be clear, that it's not. Gender is not entirely subjective. It has to be connected somehow to biological sex, but refers to the expression of that and the cultural norms that have arisen as a result of that.
You know, if I told you I was 12 years old, you and everybody else would say, no, your body matters. Your biology informs your age. If I told you I was 6'5", as much as I would have loved that when playing basketball, you'd have said, Sean, sorry, buddy, you are 5'10", probably on a good day, more like 5'9". Your body matters. If I told you I was any race but white, you'd say, sorry, buddy, your body matters. And then all of a sudden, when it comes to questions of gender identity, now we're saying we can identify apart from the anatomy and the biology. That's the divorce that primarily concerns me. Now, in some ways, I wish we had a different word for it, given the fact that in the past, gender and sex were used as synonyms. I wish we just had another word that we could agree on and still use gender to refer to sex, but we don't, because there are different ways, things that we associate that I think are random, like pink and blue. Those are completely arbitrary. And then there are other things, like maybe certain kinds of clothing that we have that actually do match our bodies more and seem to be less just completely relative and invented, like colors. But nonetheless, the way we express our sex varies across culture, and some of those are stereotypes and not healthy. So I'm with you on, I see both sides of this, but the bottom line is, I say we cannot separate our gender expression and identity if we use those terms from our bodies, because especially as Christians, we are body and soul. And you might say we are embodied souls in one sense, that our bodies are part of who we are and our souls are part of who we are. And our body, in a sense, Nancy Piercy writes in Love Thy Body, is kind of our physical self, and then our what you might call biological sex. And then gender identity is in the soul because it's psychological. It's the way I view myself. And God has designed us for those to line up. That's where I think the root of the concern is for me. But I hope this clarifies. Any other thoughts on that one?
Nope. That's a good last word on that subject.
All right. Here's one that's kind of a counseling question. And we get some of these, Scott. I'm just going to do my best. I'm not a professional counselor. The person says, I've been a Christian for 15 years. I'm the only believer in my family. My parents are older and struggling with health and stress issues. I've prayed for them, preached the gospel to them, taught them the essentials of Christianity, invited them to church. I watch evangelistic movies and play Christian podcasts, including Think Biblically, shout out, with them. Gave them a Bible. I show humility and joy. I've done all I can, yet it worries me greatly that they aren't believers. My question is whether my fear and worry might indicate that my faith and trust in God is weak, since we are instructed in Scripture not to worry, or is it a natural human concern stemming from my love for them? Scott, here's what I would say. It's interesting. Just this morning, I was reading Galatians with my students and making it clear that it's not by works of righteousness, but by God's grace and faith. Here's an individual that is doing everything, teaching, praying, preaching, watching, doing all the things seemingly right. What I would say is give yourself some grace, and this is where it just takes trusting the Lord. We cannot change people's hearts. He cares more about your parents and their faith than you and I ever could. I think of Jesus weeping over, you know, Israel. So I'm not saying to stop caring. I'm not saying to stop doing the things that you're doing. But all of us live in the tension between truth and between grace, between doing and between receiving. And you're doing everything it sounds like you humanly can. I just want to throw grace on you and say, God is proud of you. He looks down and says, well done, my good and faithful servant. Keep praying for and loving your parents the way you are and leave the results to him.
Yeah, I would not say the fact that your parents are not believers has nothing to do with whether your faith is lame and your prayer life is terrible because you've been doing everything in your power. And it may be, I don't know the situation, but maybe that it's time to maybe back off a little bit and let the Lord, let's see how God's going to work. Mm. But I think, you know, your love for your parents is real, and I think it's okay to care deeply about the eternal destiny of people that you love and care for, and to do whatever we can to at least introduce them to the gospel. And that's our responsibility, is to proclaim the gospel both verbally and with our lives. Mm. We do not have the capacity to change people's lives. That's the job of the Holy Spirit. And that's God's responsibility, not yours. And so, you know, your parents also have free will. They have the right to choose. But I think you can say that I'm sharing this with you because of how much I love you and care for you, and because of how much I want to see you come to faith in Christ, because I think that's in your best interest. And I think to couch it like that, you know, this is part of my role as your faithful son or daughter, and to communicate how much I love you. I can't help but share this side of me too. So even if they say, hey, stop talking about that stuff, I'm done with that, I think you can say, you know, humor me on this. And this is part of what I would say at your memorial. I want to say all these things to you, how much I love you and care for you while you're still living, that includes my desire for you to come to faith.
Amen. Good word, brother. And definitely double down on playing those Think Biblically episodes.
Here, here. I like that idea.
I'm honored you would play it and find it helpful with your parents. Well, Scott, it is so good to have you back. Glad you're doing better. And myself and all of our listeners are just praying that you get up to 100% in the next few weeks. This has been an episode of the podcast Think Biblically, Conversations on Faith and Culture, brought to you by Talbot School of Theology, Biola University. We offer master's programs in theology, Bible, apologetics, spiritual formation, marriage and family, and more, fully online and in person. To submit questions or make comments, please email us at thinkbiblically@biola.edu. That's thinkbiblically@biola.edu. Please consider giving us a rating on your podcast app. We are close to 1,000. That's a little goal we've had for the past couple weeks. And consider sharing this with a friend. Thanks so much for listening. And we will see you Tuesday when we have a special episode dropping in which I get to interview Scott and his brother, Mark Ray, about the kidney donation. And I'll tell you, I was just about in tears a couple times, how moving and powerful that was. You will not want to miss it coming out on Tuesday. In the meantime, remember, think biblically about everything.